selected as the perfect place to practice drawing. He looked over Bonnie's shoulder to see what she was creating. It looked to be a hill with the sun shining over it. Next to her was Nan, another little girl about Bonnie's age, whom he'd seen periodically while walking through the village. Her curly, bright red hair made her hard to miss. She was the spitting image of her mother, who often helped Laurel design some of her more intricate tapestries. Nan had inherited both her mother's hair and her soft freckles, which were scattered all over her face, but her large dark brown eyes and unusual height she got from her father, who was one of the McTierney clan's more successful farmers. "How are you doing, Nan?" he asked.
"I'm well," she said, concentrating.
Conan could see why both girls got along so well. Neither was a great talker, and it was not in Nan's nature to accept another's opinion as her own. She did not care if Bonnie knew more or was considered very smart. She had her own thoughts and ideas and was going to keep them until she decided otherwise. Conan stared at what Nan was sketching. It was surprisingly detailed for being created in dirt using a stick. "What are you drawing?" he asked.
"Today," she replied, and with that answer, the image started to make sense. The left side indicated daylight, but it quickly morphed into what was nighttime, which was the majority of the picture.
It did indeed represent the winter solstice, the shortest day and longest night of the year.
"Well, let me know if you get cold," he said.
The day was bright and sunny, which kept the cold wind from being unbearable.
Nan never looked up, but answered, "Bonnie gets cold, not me. You should ask her."
"I'm fine," Bonnie replied, half-heartedly stabbing at her sketch.
Conan wondered what was going on, for it was clear his niece was not there to learn about maps, as she had said. For days Bonnie had been hounding him to take her out and show her what he would be doing when he left. At first, the weather had not cooperated, and he had been busy helping with gathering the necessary logs for the many bonfires that would be erected over the next several days. But Conan had made a promise to Bonnie, and would chop off his arm before he let her down. So today, when he had seen the sun was high in the sky, without a cloud in sight, bringing much warmer temperatures, he had told his eldest brother that he was busy and would not be available. Thankfully, Connor had been too occupied to give more than just a hrumph, foregoing his lecture on familial responsibilities. Conan had been looking forward to spending time with his niece. It was the first time Bonnie had shown interest in what he would be doing come this spring. He had only a few months left with her, and he would cherish every memory they shared. So when he had announced that today was the day of their outing, and learned that they would be taking one of her new friends, Nan, with them, he had been highly disappointed. Now he was glad the little girl had come, for she was the only one actually interested in drawing anything. Bonnie tossed her stick on the ground. She pulled up her knees with her arms and rested her chin upon them.
"I really don't like to draw," she admitted.
Nan stopped working on her dirt picture and studied it, obviously not happy with how it had turned out. She picked up the stick to erase the evidence of her inability to execute what was in her mind, but was stopped before she could. Conan took Nan's stick from her hand.
"Why would you want to wipe all your hard work when it is so good?"
Bonnie leaned over and nodded.
"You draw like Vary."
Nan took the stick back and used it to smudge part of her work and try again.
"It's just a silly drawing," she answered.
"She does draw like Vary, doesn't she?" Conan acknowledged. "And being able to draw like you do, Nan, isn't silly. You should never stop as long as you like to do it."
"My papa says I should be busy doing other things,"
Conan nodded.
"Those other things I'm sure are very important, and you should learn to do them and make your papa proud. But you should also know that there is something special about people who can draw what they see."
Bonnie tossed her stick as far as she could.
"You should draw maps so people know where clans are and how to get to places."
"Aye, she could. But it is also important to be able to just draw pictures that people enjoy and make them smile."
"Like our mama's tapestries," Bonnie offered. "Do you draw?" Nan asked.
"In a way," Conan answered. I draw the maps Bonnie was talking about. Do you want to see? The little girl bobbed her red head. Conan smoothed a section of dirt with his hand, and then, taking Nairn's stick, quickly drew a small map on the ground of McTierney Castle, its village and the main features surrounding them, the loch, the forest and the mountains. Nairn looked up at him, her brown eyes large with awe. Then she looked at Bonnie, who just shrugged.
I told you he was a good drawer.
Conan shook his head and gave the stick back to Nairn. Not yet, but I try all the time to get better.
How?
The question had come from Nairn, who was clearly curious at how one became better at being an artist. Conan pushed up from the ground to stand up. He leaned against the boulder and looked down. By asking for help from someone.
Like Bari,
Bonnie stated. Like Bari, Conan agreed. Bonnie tilted her head to look up at her uncle. She had been curious about something for a while.
Bari used to help you with your drawing all the time. She doesn't any more. Is it because of what she said when you and Seamus were building her those fancy bookshelves?
Aye, she heard some things that she didn't like. But, Conan cautioned, as you know, she was eavesdropping at the time. Nairn pushed the stick around his drawing, adding small details here and there.
Do you not want any more lessons?
Conan took a deep breath. Both girls were young, and he could tell them anything to end this line of questioning, but he had never once treated Bonnie that way. It was one of the reasons she loved him so much. And her direct, though often childlike honesty, was one of the reasons he enjoyed her company when he tolerated that of so few others.
I would like more lessons, he answered honestly, but that is very unlikely to happen.
Bonnie looked up, squinting into the sun.
Why don't you just tell her you're sorry?
She asked innocently.
Brenna always forgives Braden for coming into our room and making a mess, but not until he says sorry. I don't know why he doesn't just say it right away, but he never does. Why?
Conan could hear the inquisitive tone in her voice and knew that she was being sincere.
Why would Braden rather be miserable dealing with Brenna being mad at him than just say he was sorry right away?
Conan sighed and crossed his arms. This seemed to be a recurring theme in his life these days. He had told Bari and said as much again at the widow's circle, and she had had mixed feelings about his response. So if Bonnie wanted to know, he was going to tell her what he had told everyone else. Braden probably refuses to apologize because Brenna is making him say it.
But I thought you were supposed to say I'm sorry when you felt bad. I always do. That's because you are a girl, Nairn explained. Boys don't like it when you make them do anything. Whenever I try to make my little brothers do something, they hate it and cause a fit.
Nairn moved to stand up. Bonnie joined her, wiping the dirt off her hands using her gown.
Is that what happened with you and Bari?
Conan nodded.
Then maybe it's a good thing you didn't apologize to Bari. It would be like saying a lie if you said I'm sorry when you weren't, just like it would be a lie to let her think you weren't sorry when you really were.
Conan stood still, regarding his beloved niece, digesting the simple truth behind what she had just said.
You know what, Bonnie? I'm going to miss you when I leave, more than you will ever know.
Bonnie leaned in and hugged him around his middle.
I'll miss you too, Uncle Conan.
Bari and Megan had sat frozen, eyes wide, barely breathing, the entire time Conan, Bonnie and Nairn had been talking. Brenna had coaxed them away from the warmth of the fire to the outdoors, professing it would be their last chance before the cold winter winds came. That alone had been enough to get Bari to agree. Eventually, Megan had capitulated, and the three had ventured outside. Bari had wanted to head to the loch, for she had started a sketch she had yet to finish there. Megan had wanted to stay close to the castle in case the wind picked up and it became too cold, but it was Brenna who had finally decided where they were to go, mostly because she would not take no for an answer. Soon after they had settled down on a large blanket, Brenna had jumped up, saying that she had forgotten something,
and then run off to fetch it. Fari had already gotten out her paper and stylus, and Megan, not wanting to walk all the way to the castle and back again, had decided to remain with Fari. Fari had been teasing Megan about Seamus, and whether he was finally going to make his feelings known during the festivities, when Bonnie and Conan's voices could be heard just on the other side of the large rock. The boulder was enormous, and no one knew exactly how it got there. There were a few massive rocks randomly found in the area. The most prominent one was by the loch. The boulders, like the big oak, were common meeting points, so Vary had thought nothing of it when Brenna had suggested they sit there that afternoon. But the moment she had heard Conan's deep baritone sounds, she had known that Brenna had laid a trap. It was not until she had seen the shock in Megan's face that she had believed her friend had not been involved. But she, too, had come to the same conclusion. Recovering from the jolt, Vary had been about to plop her things down on the ground, stand up and make her presence known, when she heard Conan start to talk about Nairn's ability to draw, and how it was a special gift. When he mentioned that it was just as important to create something for people to enjoy as it was to produce a map, tears had formed in her eyes. But it had been the end, the discussion between him and Bonnie about why men sometimes don't like to apologize, that had made her finally understand what Conan had been trying to say to her. It wasn't that he was not sorry. He was. But like any normal man, he did not want to be told what to feel or say. Vary quietly stood up and smoothed out her gown. "Perhaps you and I should stop eavesdropping." Megan nodded, and both women stepped around the boulder into Conan's line of sight. He was leaning against the large rock, with both his ankles and arms crossed, looking more handsome than any man should. When he only cocked a brow, she took a deep breath and exhaled. "How long did you know we were there?"
"Not long," he assured her. "I only knew it when I heard you stand up. I thought you might be trying to sneak away."
"I thought about it," Vary acknowledged. Megan appeared, grumbling. "I was not an accomplice to this." She swirled her finger to include everyone. "Supposedly impromptu get-together. Not only is it too cold, but its purpose eludes me." Conan glanced at Bonnie, who quickly looked away, and said,
"I think we all know who was behind today's scheme."
Vary looked down to see what the red-headed girl was drawing, and indeed a representation of the winter solstice was staring up at her. She wondered what Nairn would be able to accomplish with an actual stylus, and decided that she would have to seek her out to show her how to build a cloth board.
"So is this what brought you out today?"
Nairn looked up, shaking her head. She pointed a finger at Conan.
"He was telling us about maps."
"Very interesting." A bemused smile formed on Vary's lips as she glanced back at Conan. "Do you know, in all the times we came out here, you never once told me about your maps, or showed me what it is to be a map maker. It was always me showing you what I did, never the reverse."
"Are you asking now?"
"I suppose I am."
Conan studied her for a moment, assessing whether or not she was serious. He must have decided she was, for he pushed himself erect.
"First, most scholars do not call those who draw maps map-makers, but map-painters. That is because most have no interest in creating actual maps, but in creating art. Their fabricated symmetry holds little accuracy, and certainly nothing that shows where bodies of land and water are. Instead, they illustrate concepts, and almost always religious ones."
Vary was already fascinated. She loved learning anything new, and moved to get more comfortable by leaning on the boulder in the very space he had just vacated.
"Those that aren't religious still are not very useful, for no measurements are used to demonstrate scale. Almost everyone I have ever seen does not make use of longitudes and latitudes, but instead uses methods that predate Ptolemy and Anaximander."
"Who's Anaximander?"
"He was a Greek philosopher who lived more than 2,000 years ago. He was the headmaster of a school and drew what many believe is the first accurate map of the known world. Unfortunately, one of his students, Anaximenes, thought his ideas wrong and put forth that the world was of a rectangular form instead of round.
Bonnie, who had sat back down and was watching Nan doodle in the dirt, had also been paying attention to what Conan was saying.
"What does the world look like?"
"Round," Conan answered. "Maybe like a potato, but it is definitely not flat."
"But how do you know?"
Bonnie pressed, skepticism lining her voice.
"I've seen proof."
He knelt down and found a large, mostly round rock and handed it to Bonnie.
"Now hold it out from you. Do you see the edge of the rock and how it curves?"
She nodded.
"Well, the world does the same thing."
"It does?" Vari asked, holding out a rock for herself, mimicking what Conan was showing Bonnie.
"Aye. If you ever get a chance to go to the sea, look out at the horizon, and right where the water's edge meets the sky, you will see a line just like you do with the rock. If the world was flat, the line would be straight, but it's not. It bends," Conan explained.
He stood back up and went to stand next to Vari.
"Now some people think that the bend means the world is just shaped like a flat disk, but Aristotle ended that argument not long after Anaximander."
Vari frowned. She took a few steps and threw her rock, silently impressed with how far it went. She then swiped her hands together to get the dirt off.
"I'm not sure how much math proves the world is round."
"He didn't just use math, but logic. The lunar eclipse, for example."
"Aye, but that is the moon."
"Then what about the stars?"
Conan reached down and picked up the rock that Bonnie had discarded and gave it to Vari. He then picked up a small pebble and held it high above the rock.
"Think about the stars when you travel. They are not in the same place."
He pointed to a place on the rock.
"Let's say this is the world, and you were standing here. You look straight up, and there are the stars."
He wiggled the pebble.
"But if you go to a different spot, when you look up, they would be in a different place. And if you go far enough," he moved his finger to the other side, "you would not be able to see them at all, but new ones."
Vari's mouth parted with understanding.
"And that is why ships always seem to sink as they move away out of view."
"Amazing,"
Vari said with heartfelt wonder. Conan chucked the pebble and then took the rock from her palm, sending it far past the one Vari had thrown earlier.
"And it is not only Aristotle who thinks the world is round. I haven't read it, but a man named Eleusidarius wrote a book that is supposed to have evidence that we live on a sphere, and Johannes de Sacrobosco's work was based on Ptolemy."
"Who's Ptolemy?"
Conan began to walk to where he'd thrown the rocks. Vari grabbed one of the tartans, threw it across her shoulders, and fell in beside him.
"It's his discoveries that are going to enable me to create the maps I want. Because the world is round and drawings are flat, it is intrinsically very difficult to capture land accurately."
"That might be one of the reasons people stopped trying."
"Aye," Conan agreed, kicking one of the smaller stones farther away. "It is much easier to put Jerusalem in the middle of everything and place things randomly around it. But representing the world is possible."
"Let me guess. Ptolemy?"
A grin lit up Conan's face.
"Aye. Ptolemy developed precise methods for identifying exactly where something is on the world. He came up with a coordinate system made up of latitudes and longitudes. Using a stick, he drew a straight line. If you knew the coordinates..." He paused to draw a second line intersecting the first. "You could go to a specific spot anywhere in the world, even if you had never before been there."
Vari stared at the spot where the two lines met, and then back up at Conan, her eyes wide with astonishment.
"Is that really true?"
Conan nodded. "Ptolemy assigned coordinates to more than 8,000 locations and put them into a book, Geographia.
And you plan to do the same thing, but for Scotland?"
Conan bobbed his head again.
"That is my dream."
"I now see what you meant about drawings needing to have real value. If you really could create such maps, they would be very powerful pieces of information."
"I was wrong to say that. The world also needs more beauty in it. Not everything has to have a tangible benefit."
Vari gasped. She stopped short and grabbed his forearm. "Did I hear you right?" It took a second for him to comprehend Bari's question. With a smirk, he answered,
"You heard me say I was wrong, not that I was sorry."
Bari shrugged as a smile tipped the corners of her mouth and grew from there. "I know, and I think hearing you admit you were wrong sounds sweeter than an apology."
Conan chuckled. "You'll never know."
He stared down into her eyes, and Bari's body responded to his seductive gaze. She could feel herself start to sway closer and forced herself to step back.
How did you become so interested in maps?"
Conan stared at her with mixed feelings.
"Father Lanoly, seeing that I've always been interested in books and learning, usually brought me with him when he went to visit other priests. About 9 or 10 years ago, we went to one abbey where there was a visiting scholar from Italy, who was similarly fascinated with the idea of capturing the world on paper. He told me of the travels of Marco Polo and the faraway places to which he had been, and at that moment I knew what I wanted to do. So I stayed there and learned everything he had to teach me about maps, their origin and history. Since then, I continued my studies, especially anything that was associated with Ptolemy and how to calculate coordinates."
They continued walking and talking, and Conan answered all her questions about how he intended to capture the various topography he might encounter. They were still debating certain difficulties when a strong breeze came up, and Mari began to rub her arms.
"I think the wind is getting colder."
Conan nodded and went to tell Bonnie and Nan to pack things up, that they were returning to the castle, but no one was in sight.
"When did they leave?"
Bari smiled.
"Some time ago. Megan was not in the mood for an outing in the first place. They said goodbye, but you were telling me about how Aristotle proved the world was round."
Now that Bari mentioned it, Conan did faintly recall Bonnie saying something to him.
"Another gust of wind swept across them. We should head in."
Bari nodded and tried to tuck wisps of her hair back. "I hope this breeze doesn't mean rain is coming. I've never been to a bonfire, and I don't want it to be cancelled."
Conan looked up and sniffed. "I detect no moisture, just the cold."
Bari shivered, emphasizing his point.
"Come on, let's get you back to the castle and indoors."
Bari fell in beside him, her own long strides easily keeping up with his. Her mind was spinning on all that Conan had said, going back to even their first conversations on their ride from the Priory.
"I was wondering something about your maps."
Conan was rubbing his hands together and blowing into them for warmth.
"And that was?" he prompted.
"You mentioned that you wanted to include enough detail so that someone could use them to know what the land looked like at that very spot."
"Aye, that is why I asked you to give me lessons."
"But the map I saw in your chambers was of a large area. It would be impossible to capture the overall shape of the land and include that level of detail."
Conan sighed.
"I know. I'm still trying to figure out a way to address that issue. Symbols might work, but I might just have to accept that I won't be able to capture as much as I would like on a single sheet of vellum."
"Have you ever considered including a symbol where you want to show more detail? That symbol could be related to a specific drawing. Then, if someone wanted to see more of that area, they could flip to a particular drawing. Then the main map would not be cluttered with information some may not be interested in."
Conan began to rub his hands together vigorously. Excitement coursed through him, for it was the perfect solution.
"You know what this means?" He gave his most dazzling smile. "I need more lessons."
Bari lifted her lashes and found herself looking into laughing eyes. The happy glint in the bright blue pools was enough to make her racing heart to skip a beat.
"We'll begin again after Christmastide," she promised.
Chapter 10 Bonnie flopped onto her bed and groaned.
"It's never going to work."
"Of course it will," Brenna said dismissively as she pulled the thick tartan around her shoulders tightly and sat down in front of the fire.
"I told you what happened.
Today was a complete success. Bonnie grabbed her pillow and started tossing it in the air and then catching it.
You said they didn't kiss?
I said they almost kissed, Brenna clarified, trying to keep her teeth from chattering. Normally the cold did not bother her, but she had been outside a long time, spying on everything that had happened after she had exited Megan and Mari's company, before they realized what she had done. And based on what she had witnessed, Mari was not going to be mad at her either.
Seeing them almost kiss proves that our plan is working, Bonnie.
Well, Mama almost figured it out today. She came looking for you.
Brenna jumped to her feet and went to stand over Bonnie.
What did you see?
Unfazed by her sister's malevolent stare, Bonnie said,
I told her the truth, that you were with Uncle Cornyn and Mari.
Why did you do that? Now Mama will be suspicious and start asking questions. If she learns that Uncle Cornyn and Mari are about to get together, she will do something and ruin things again.
Bonnie threw the pillow in her older sister's face to get her to back away.
What should I have said? Bonnie yelped, seeing Brenna prepare for revenge. She would have found out the truth if I said something else. This way Mama knew you were safe and didn't keep looking for you.
Brenna considered that rationalization and then threw the pillow back down forcefully before returning to her blanket and the fire.
Well, all we have to do now is make Uncle Cornyn heroic.
Everyone already knows he's brave.
Brenna shook her head. He needs to do a heroic act to be a hero. Bonnie grunted.
That's going to be impossible.
Why? Brenna challenged.
How are we going to create a situation where Uncle Cornyn can be a hero? Do you know how hard it was to get him to go outside the castle today? And now that he knows I tricked him, he's going to suspect everything I say.
Bonnie turned on her side and propped her head up with her hand.
And both Mari and Megan are going to be worse.
Brenna tapped her chin. I've thought about that, she said with a smile. And you're right. We, she pointed to Bonnie and then herself, can't do it. Bonnie's eyes grew wide.
Not Mama.
Brenna shook her head in agreement.
I was thinking about someone Mari and Cornyn would never suspect, she said as her impish grin grew even larger.
You want me to do what? Megan gasped. You cannot be serious.
Brenna gave what she hoped to be her newest ally her most infectious grin and bobbed her head.
Will you do it?
Megan's head pulled back as if she were trying to avoid someone's fist.
Of course I won't do it.
She had come up to the girls' bedchambers to talk to them about their antics that afternoon, not get drawn into another one of their schemes. All their eavesdropping and plotting was stirring up trouble, and if it did not stop, someone was going to get hurt. Megan had intended to give them one last warning, with a promise that if they instigated any more surprises, their father was going to be told. Megan normally would have gone to Laurel about the situation, but Connor had made it very clear that no one, and he meant no one, was to unduly stress his wife. And Megan had no idea whether Laurel would be angry or secretly delighted that her daughters were following in her matchmaking footsteps. She had barely taken two steps inside the room when Brenna had squealed with excitement upon seeing her. Unable to utter even a single word of her lecture, Megan had been guided to one of the chairs and forced to listen to the craziest matchmaking plan ever concocted.
"Brenna," Megan began, trying to ignore the little girl's hopeful look. "I think it is sweet that you want to bring Mari and Cornyn together, but it will never work."
Brenna giggled.
"But it is working."
Seeing the continued doubt in Megan's eyes, she gave her best evidence to prove she was right.
"Mari and Cornyn almost kissed today. Their mouths were that far apart."
She created an inch of space between her index finger and her thumb.
"And they would have, if Mari had not taken a step back."
Megan licked her lips. Mari had forgotten to include that little detail in her summary of what had transpired, after she, Bonnie, and Nan had left for the warmth of the castle's fires.
"How do you know?"
Brenna raised her shoulders along with her hands.
"I was there,"
she answered with an impish grin. Megan closed her eyes and looked upward, praying silently for both patience and guidance. Someday, Brenna was going to hear something she should not and get into serious trouble. Her only hope to avoid that fate was to break this awful habit of hers.
"Brenna, you were out there that entire time."
When she nodded, Megan sought for calm and said,
"It's too cold to be outside for so long, and you could have gotten very ill. But more importantly, your uncle would have been furious to learn that you had been spying on him out there."
"It's not like I wanted to be there," Brenna announced in her defense. "But there was no other way to know if our plan was working, or if we had to do honorable all over again. But it did work."
Brenna got to her feet and held out four fingers.
"Barry wanted someone who was honest."
Brenna pulled down one finger.
"Kind."
A second finger disappeared.
"Honorable." Down came a third. "And a hero."
She waved her remaining index finger at Megan.
"That's the only one we still need to do to prove to Barry that she can fall in love with Uncle Conan."
Megan slunk back into her chair. With her elbow on the sidearm, she rested her forehead in her hand.
If only love were that easy to turn off and on.
Sometimes she wished she could simply dismiss what she felt for Clyde and find happiness and love with someone else, maybe even Seamus. But it was not that easy. Peeking out from her hand, she asked,
"Why do you want them together so badly?"
Brenna breathed in deeply and exhaled.
"I want Uncle Conan to be happy before he leaves. It is his turn to fall in love and get married. Until Barry, I didn't think it possible, but she liked him when no one else ever did. She just needs to fall in love with him."
"But how do you know that Conan loves her?"
"He keeps kissing her,"
Bonnie answered. Megan swung around.
"What does that prove? Lots of men kiss women, and while you may want it to mean love, it often doesn't, especially in the case of your uncle."
Bonnie, who was lying on her stomach with her head on the heels of her palms, shook her head.
"They all kissed him. He never kissed them. The only women he ever kissed were the two widows that live outside the village."
Megan's jaw dropped an inch.
How do you know them?"
she asked, even though she knew the answer.
"I heard him tell Seamus once," Bonnie replied. "Uncle Conan was mad that Seamus believed all the soldiers' chatter about him being with lots of women, just because lots of women had chased him."
Megan was shocked. She had been one of those people, and she was sure that Laurel was among them as well.
"Why did Conan never say anything?"
"He didn't want to," Bonnie answered. "He thought the rumors would help keep women away, and he especially didn't want Mama to find him a wife."
Megan felt her jaw tighten. Once again she had been played. It did not matter that she understood Conan's reasons, but that he had successfully fooled all of them about his non-existent exploits was rankling.
"So you think because Vary is the first one he has kissed?" "More than once," Brenna chimed in. "More than once, that Conan is in love with her."
Brenna nodded. Megan looked back at Bonnie, who was also nodding.
"I don't think he knows it, though," the 7-year-old added. "Or if he even wants to be, but he looks exactly like Uncle Craig and Uncle Crevin did when they were in love."
A disturbing thought came to Megan.
"How do you know they kissed before?" "Barry told you about the one that happened just before she went on a picnic, and I saw the last one. If you had seen them, you would want them together, too. They kiss like Mama and Papa do."
Megan swallowed at the idea that Brenna, whom she loved like a little sister, had secretly witnessed what sounded to be a very heated embrace.
"You were there? Because Mari told me she had opened the passageway and made sure you were not around."
Brenna bit her bottom lip, realizing her mistake.
"There is more than one secret area in a lot of rooms. I don't know where they all are either. She won't tell even me,"
Bonnie chimed in, hoping to make Megan feel better for not knowing about the second secret hiding spot.
"Why don't you want Barry and Uncle Conan to be together?"
Megan's eyebrows rose as she searched for an adequate answer.
Finding none, she finally said, "It's not that I don't want them together. I just think they would get mad if they found out that people were trying to trick them into falling in love. Love should find its own way." Brenna scoffed and crossed her arms.
"Then it will never happen. They don't have years like Craig and Meriel did to figure out that they should be more than friends. Vary and Conan are leaving in the spring. That's why they need our help." "Uncle Conan won't be mad if Vary and he get together. He's nicer when he's around her. And Vary would be happier if she were with Conan. She doesn't really want to go with her father."
Now that was something Megan knew for certain was incorrect.
"Aye, she does. Vary has told me several times how she never wanted to marry."
Bonnie looked unconcerned.
"She just doesn't want to live in a house and never go anywhere. Uncle Conan is never going to live in one place and is going to travel all the time. He could make her happy, but she won't believe it unless we can finish her list."
Megan realized she was nodding her head and immediately stopped. She could not believe she was being sucked into their logic.
"And that's why we need your help. All we have left is Hero, and we can't prove Uncle Conan is one without you."
Megan rose to her feet and wagged her finger. "But it's not me you really want. You think I can get Seamus to agree, but he won't. It will be a waste of time even asking. I can promise you there is no way he would agree to any part of your plan." Brenna would not be daunted.
"He would, if you asked him."
Megan pursed her lips together. She believed Brenna was wrong, but part of her wondered if she really did have that kind of power over Seamus. Since she could remember, she had loved Clyde, and she still did, but lately it had been very hard to keep from also falling for Seamus. The man was kind, handsome, funny, and most importantly, here. And something deep inside her knew that he would always be there for her, whereas Clyde had proven that he would not. She refused to let Clyde go, yet she did not want to even entertain the notion of seeing Seamus woo another woman, even if it was all part of Brenna's crazy plan. "Maybe, but I'm not going to put him in a position of saying no." Even though that was what she would want to hear, he might say yes, if only to keep from disappointing her. It was truly a no-win situation for both her and him. Brenna's expression hardened, and her normally clear grey eyes turned into dark storm clouds as frustration sank in. She had to find something to convince Megan to help Vary, and as that thought entered her mind, another did as well. Something she remembered her mama telling her friend Eileen. The easiest way to persuade someone to do something was to show them why it was in their best interest. Brenna began to pace, thinking of all the things Megan wanted that were in her power to give or make happen. Problem was, she was only 10 years old. She had no power, only information. Brenna stopped in front of Megan and looked her dead in the eye.
"What if I promised not to listen to you again while Vary and Conan are still here?"
Megan opened her mouth to dismiss the bribe, but then closed it again when she was struck with the possibilities. This potential compromise had enormous merit.
"Promise me forever?" Brenna's eyes got huge. "Forever?" she wailed softly in pain. "That's a very long time."
Megan nodded. "It's forever, as in never again." Just the sound of it was making Megan excited. Privacy. She had not realized until tonight how little of it she had, if Brenna had a mind to spy on her. She suddenly wanted this deal quite badly.
"If I ask Seamus to help, you promise not to spy on me for the rest of your life, even if he refuses."
Brenna's shoulders slumped even more.
"But you have to really try and convince him."
Megan smiled an evil smile.
"I think I could, if you are willing to make the same promise to him. If Seamus agrees to do his part in your little plan, you have to promise never to eavesdrop on him either."
Brenna threw her head back as if she was struck.
"That's not fair. After Vary and Conan leave, you and Seamus will be the only interesting people around here."
Megan licked her lips, worried that her harsh stipulations might be too onerous for someone who thrived on listening to gossip.
but the idea of Brenna never eavesdropping on her again was a prize she desperately wanted. If you find yourself too bored, you could always ask to visit your Uncle Cole. Barra Krakown is a huge castle, and you know a lot of people there. Jamie, Donald, Breege, and your Aunt Eleanor. Just imagine what fun you could have visiting them. Megan felt a twinge of remorse, because she had no doubt that because of her suggestion, Brenna would somehow find her way north to her uncle's home for an extended visit. Brenna's head snapped back up as if the weight of the world was no longer on her shoulders. Her grey eyes were twinkling, and Megan's guilt melted away when she heard two words, "I agree."
"You want me to do what?" Seamus sneered in disbelief. "You must be mad."
He blinked and shook his head as the dozens of reasons why her suggestion was inconceivable ran through his mind. Megan waved her hands back and forth in denial.
"I don't want you to do anything. Brenna and Bonnie do."
"But you must want me to agree to be asking."
"That's not true,"
Megan strongly denied, and reached out to clutch his forearm so he could feel the truth.
"I think their plan is as outrageous as you do. I refused to get involved, but then Brenna promised me that she would never eavesdrop on me again."
Her sky-blue eyes were large with delight at the concept.
"How could I refuse just for asking you a question?"
"That I can understand, but there is no way I am going to seek out Vardy and pretend to be interested in her during the festivities in order to make Conan jealous."
Megan winced.
"It's a little more than that. You have to try and kiss her. Brenna has some notion that if Conan witnessed this, that he would step in and become the hero they believe Vari wants."
Seamus stood frozen with his arms crossed, unblinking, for several long seconds at Megan.
"You cannot be serious."
Megan bit her bottom lip.
"They believe Vari loves him, but will only admit it once they prove Conan is honest, kind, honorable, and a hero. They say they've done the first three, and all they need now is to show that he is indeed a hero. Hence Vari needs to be saved from your advances."
Seamus tilted his head upward and studied the ceiling rafters of the lower hall. It was the one place Connor had made sure there were no secret passageways, hidden rooms, or obscure places for Brenna to hide in. This was where he held his meetings with his commanders and other lairds when they were visiting, and the discussion was serious. He had not barred the hidden spots in the Star Tower. It was rare, but if a fire broke out and the stairwell was blocked, or if, God forbid, the castle was attacked and somehow invaded, Connor wanted a way to get his family out of the tower, from any room, to safety.
"I doubt they've proven he's kind," Seamus mumbled. "And as far as jealousy, I don't think Conan is capable of the emotion."
"Simply because someone has not been jealous over someone before does not mean he wouldn't be."
Seamus looked back down.
"Are you talking about you or Conan?"
A piece of him hoped Megan would admit that she would not like seeing him seek the attentions of another woman. Megan lifted her chin.
"Conan, of course."
She may not think Brenna's idea would work, but she did believe Conan felt something a lot more than friendship for Vari, based on his reactions both during and after their fights.
"Why would I be jealous, when I know it is all a ruse?"
Seamus lifted a single brow.
"You really think Conan is going to stop me from kissing Vari, when he didn't with Loman?"
Megan took a step back and threw up her hands.
"What do we care if it works? Brenna's promise is not based on success. We simply need to try. The only reason I am doing this is for privacy. I would think you might want that, too."
Seamus looked back down and studied Megan as if he was trying to discern whether he should read more meaning into her last comment. Agreeing would mean they would both have privacy. Something he would definitely want and be willing to do almost anything to get, with Brenna seemingly everywhere. But only if Megan was seriously considering letting go of the possibility of Clyde ever returning.
"And why would I want privacy, Megan? Right now I'm not doing anything Brenna would care to listen to. So are you saying that might change?"
"I don't know," she answered honestly. "But all this talk about Vari and Conan deserving to be happy is making me think that I deserve that too."
Seamus took a step forward and leaned down until his face neared hers. "Assuming that's true, I'll do it. But when this is all over, be prepared, Megan." Megan stared into his eyes and swallowed. She did not need to ask what he meant. She knew.
Chapter 11. "The sword dance is next," Callum said with a wink, handing Vari a mug of ale. "Dance with me?"
Vari laughed, and her eyes began to gleam with anticipation. "You mean dance against you?" she said, taking the cup. "I think the only reason you like to dance next to me is that I make you look good."
"I am good, and that is not the only reason I like to dance next to you. It's because I am the envy of every man in the room when I do."
"You're incorrigible."
Callum winked.
"I'm going to get the swords."
He disappeared into the crowd. Vari leaned back against the wall of the Great Hall and took a sip of the cool ale. Tomorrow was Epiphany and the last day of the Christmastide festivities. She did not want to think about all the merriment coming to an end. The holiday season could last another week, and she would still not want it to be over. Never had she had so much fun, and it saddened her to think that this might be her only chance to enjoy the 12 days of Christmas as they were meant to be experienced. Travelling merchants did not have celebrations with large bonfires, dancing, and feasts like those held by clans. Longtime McTierney ally Ray Sheldon, his two daughters, who had married twin McTierney brothers, and his grandson Sean had arrived the night the celebrations started. Unfortunately, their stay was not going to be an extended one. Though Vari had only met Rayland and Meriel, Quevin and Craig's wives, a few days ago, she already considered them friends. Both women were not just lovely, but also highly spirited and mischievous. Nothing was more comical than watching them interact with their husbands. They had the kind of relationship she would want if she ever were inclined to make a marital commitment. Neither wife nor husband capitulated to the other when riled, and one could not help but see the great love and respect the two couples had for each other. They gave and supported, but when provoked, they also stood up to the other. Craig and Crevin did not dictate to their wives, though they periodically tried, and Meriel and Rayland did not harangue their husbands, though they were not above various forms of persuasion. The most joyful of the four was Rayland. She was pregnant with her first child, which was due in late spring. It had been quite a massive effort for Rayland to convince Crevin to let her come. She had been pregnant before and lost the child, and that fear never really quite left either of their minds. So Rayland did not argue when Crevin announced that they would be leaving the day after Epiphany. But like Vari, Rayland did not want to think about the days after the merriment was over. She only wished to focus on enjoying the little time there was left. Rayland had sat with the similarly pregnant Laurel in the Great Hall much of the time, each keeping the other company, watching everyone as they drank and danced. Vari found watching them amusing, especially Laurel. Lady McTierney, despite growing large with child, practically danced from her chair. Her light blonde hair swung about, for she could not keep her feet still when the music played. But it was when the swords began to appear that a much greater level of excitement shone in her normally storm-coloured eyes. The sword dance had grown into something of a unique rivalry between the Sheldon and McTierney clans, having evolved into a challenge of endurance. The music would start, and members of each clan would pound the floor to an ever-increasing tempo, deftly hopping among the quarters made by crossing two broadswords. The music would continue until only one person was left and declared the champion. The clan that claimed the winner also claimed bragging rights that they exercised whenever possible until the next festivity and sword dance. For years, only men had participated, but one night Laurel had decided to join them, having failed to understand why women had been excluded from even trying. Honestly believing she did not have a chance at lasting very long, let alone winning the challenge, the men from both the McTierney and Sheldon clans had allowed her to join the competition, mostly to prove their assumptions true.
To everyone's surprise, except Laurel's, she had won. Ever since then, clanswomen had participated in the sword dance. Megan, who had never won, but had come close a few times, had warned Bari ahead of time about what was to come. For days leading up to Christmastide, the two women had practiced the steps. After 10 nights of hopping around for a quarter of an hour, she was getting better, but she would have to more than double that time to ever have a chance at winning. It would take months to build up a level of endurance to be anything close to competitive. But it did not matter. Bari loved the dance. During her first sword dance, Callum came up and introduced himself. Bari recognized the name, and knew immediately he was the Sheldon guard whom Megan kept mentioning, and for good reason. Callum was startlingly handsome for a Highland soldier. Several of the McTiernay men were very good-looking, but Callum attracted the eye of every woman around him, Bari included. Possessing a classic rugged bone structure, unusual turquoise-coloured eyes, and thick dark auburn hair, Callum was almost too handsome. But it was more than his looks that drew women to his side. One could tell just by looking at him, how he walked, stood, and spoke with soft authority, that he could take care of himself and anyone he cared for. So when Callum had begun to flirt with her, Bari could not help but be flattered. But she was surprised to discover that there was much more to the man than an attractive smile and gorgeous body. Callum was honest, fair, and extremely witty. She was always entertained when he was around, and therefore never felt compelled to avoid his company. And since Conan had been in a disagreeable mood since practically the festivities had begun, she had been in Callum's company a lot. Bari had tried a few times to pull Conan out of his surly mindset and get him to join her in some of the diversions, but he had made it clear that he would rather be left alone to sulk. So she had honoured his unsaid request. This Christmastide was her first with festivities, and she had refused to let them be ruined by his churlish attitude. There was too much fun to be had, and she was determined to relish every second. By the third night of revelry, however, Bari began to realize Conan was not alone in his strange behavior. Bonnie and Brenna, who had been her two shadows for weeks, were suddenly never around. Bari only saw them here and there, and each time only briefly. At first she was concerned they were up to a new scheme, but after a couple of nights of dancing, drinking, and laughing, she no longer cared. If the two girls were hatching a plan, it would soon be known, and if that plan included Conan, it was sure to fail. So Bari stopped worrying about them. She could not say the same for Seamus and Megan, however. Those two were almost always together, which at first was encouraging, until Bari realized they were rarely smiling. What was really bothersome was their frowns were usually aimed in her direction, as if they were anxious about something. Thinking it was Callum's attention that had them concerned, Bari had tried to assure them that the handsome soldier and she were simply enjoying each other's company. That while Callum might be a bit over the top with his flattery, it was all in fun. They both knew he would be returning with the Sheldons when Christmastide was over. Unfortunately, her reassurances seemed to do very little to relieve the apprehensive looks on either Megan or Seamus's faces. So again, Bari had decided to put her concerns aside as much as possible and focus on having fun. Megan pulled the blanket up and tucked it around Bonnie's sweet face. She looked so tired, but also determined. After 11 nights of festivities, Laurel was getting tired earlier in the night. Being pregnant, she was not running around like she normally did, and therefore had been able to keep a much closer eye on her daughters. This year, they had not been able to wander about like they had in the past. So when Laurel had wanted to leave hours before the feast would be drawing to a close, both girls had begged her to stay with Megan. Megan had agreed, despite knowing that they would confront her later. For Seamus had yet to corner Bari for that ill-fated kiss, and Brenna and Bonnie wanted to know why.
"Seamus isn't going to do it, is he?"
Bonnie asked with a yawn. Brenna grabbed a blanket, wrapped it around her shoulders, and sat on Bonnie's bed, waiting for Megan to answer. Megan did not like to disappoint them, especially as she and Seamus had told them that they would try, but in this case she just could not fault Seamus for deciding that he couldn't fulfill his promise. Each night she and Seamus had huddled together and talked about the best way to approach Barry, what he could say, and how to best entice her away from the crowd. Once he approached Barry, Megan was to give a signal to Brenner, who would be responsible for convincing Conan to come out and intervene. But there had never been a perfect time, and tonight Seamus had admitted that he just could not do it. "I can't, Megan. I know I said I would, but it feels wrong. It's a lie. I cannot do that to either Conan or Barry. You and she are close, but I also like her, and don't want to lose our friendship, not to mention Conan's. There are other ways to deal with Brenner." Megan had leaned into Seamus and buried her face in his chest with his admission, relief flooding her every limb. She had pushed those same feelings aside, trying to stay focused on the positives, but that first night, when they had looked at Barry with the intention of trying to deceive her, she had known deep down it was wrong. Seamus had wrapped his arms around her, and it had felt so good and surprisingly right. Megan had not wanted to move, to ever leave their haven, and would not have if Seamus had not gently separated them. "But I do have an idea." Using his chin, he had pointed to Callum, who was once again talking and laughing with Barry. "What about Callum?" Megan had leaned back. "Callum? Aye, he wouldn't be pretending to have an interest in Barry. It's real, and it would not be a surprise either. I bet if an opportunity arose, he would take advantage. I know I would." That had really got Megan's attention, and she had stepped totally out of his embrace. "You would?" He had reached out and touched her hand and said, "If it were the right woman, and I thought for a moment that it would be welcomed." Megan had not known what to say, and only swallowed. Then, with a brief glance at Callum and Barry, she had asked, "So, what do you propose?" Megan briefly explained Seamus's idea to Brenner and Bonnie, and waited as the two girls mulled it over. If Brenner agreed Callum was a suitable substitute, she was still going to hold the 10-year-old to her promise of privacy. Brenner finally nodded. It was probably more from lack of options, but she agreed.
"Use the same signal to let us know when we need to get Uncle Conan."
Conan stood impassively as Vary sashayed up to him, her luscious pink lips wearing a large smile. Once again, she was more beautiful than any woman had a right to look, in his opinion. A natural blush shaded her high cheekbones, made only more attractive with her olive complexion. Pale green eyes framed with dark lashes were full of mirth as she looked at him. Then the smell of sunshine and grass mixed with the sweetness of flowers washed over him, and he felt his lower body grow painfully hard as the feeling of her in his arms flooded his memory. Barry had not even said a word, and yet once again he was trying to quash the rush of sexual desire that stirred in him whenever she was near. Could one kiss really ruin a person's life? Conan feared that was what had happened to him. Never had he thought it possible to desire a woman so much. Beautiful women were dangerous creatures, and this time it was he who had fallen prey to Vary's charms. It was getting so he dreaded going to sleep. Not a night went by that he did not dream of her, and during the day it was no better. The very first night of Christmastide, when Vary had arrived with Megan, his stomach had turned completely sour. She had worn a deep blue ankle-length chance with a rich gold-coloured blio over it. A band of intricate needlework circled the long sleeves, hem, and belt of the tunic. The ensemble clung to her breasts like honey. The gold intensified her exotic features and brought out the rich dark brown of her hair, which was styled mostly in a soft updo, with the rest hanging in a single curl off to one side. When Barry had entered the hall, he had seen all the heads swivel to see who was causing a stir. But Sheldon's guard, whom women had declared the ideal man for years, had been the most enamoured and taken with her beauty. Vari, however, had not immediately returned his admiration, which had only fueled